Start of interview with M. Rajendra, 31st of May 1967.
And when you entered the service in the late 30s and...
I joined in 34.
Now taking think of the whole period.
Yeah.
30s and 40s. What would you say were the prevailing characteristics in the orientation of civil service?
Or by orientation, what do you mean? Social attitudes?
Yes, social attitudes. In what ways did they look on their job? And what were they trying to achieve?
Well, very much the paternalism of the colonial period persisted. There was no real thinking on terms of economic growth that a modern government thinks.
Mm-hmm.
There was with transfer of power to Ceylonese, the collection of revenue part of it was not so predominant a role in the life of the civil servant. Make life of the peasantry a little easier was very much the attitude, and that the life of the peasant was people living in the villages was dull, drab. Came to the forefront of the malaria epidemic of 1933-34, and Mr. D. S. Naika was the influence, and his attitude was really try to improve the lot of the peasantry.
So it would be correct to call it an elitist concept of impersonal guardianship.
Yes, I think it was a concept of impersonal guardianship. Following up on the best of the colonial tradition.
Mm-hmm. And your personal case, when you joined the service, what was your attitude? Was it just a job or did you consider it a mission? I may put it in an exaggerated form.
No, possibly if I had left myself, I might have done law. Circumstances of my father dying about the time that I was at university made it necessary for me to get a job as quickly as possible. And the prestige job available that was the civil service, and I had a fling and got in. But having got in, what fascinated me was the opportunity to work in the countryside and do something to better the lot of people living in the countryside.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder whether you met Leach. He was my first GA.
I met him.
And, he was... he greatly influenced my outlook because we worked together in Hambantota. And there... He certainly devoted himself very, very much to work and to trying to better the lot of people.
He didn't strike me as a sort who would be the party-going type, but would prefer.
Oh yes, Leach, for instance, was far from being a party man. He was a very hard-working, hard-grinding sort of person. Who spent much of his time in the villages, and when he was in headquarters, he worked from, say, 7 in the morning till 7 at night, cleared all of his work and got back to the field again.
But what about the question of establishing a rapport with the village folk? Since I presume your background was westernized, and then in the case of the Europeans, there were various other obstacles. How close could you get to the grassroots?
Well, to the grassroots, I belong to the motor car owning era. The result was that you seldom or never camped out in the village. But we did come into fairly intimate contact with the village in land and irrigation work. We did very considerable amount of field inspection, where you went out into the village, went to the site of trouble, inspected the site, found out the problems of the village. Also, when we mapped out land and the land development ordinance, again, you did meet the village. Land catcheries, you met them in the crowd, and investigating applications for lands, you did come to know fairly intimately village problems and what pressures there were. But certainly you never got the opportunity of making a friend of a person resident in the village.
Mm-hmm. Did you consider the fact that you, I mean looking back, the fact that you can't camp out, would you look on it as somewhat regrettable in certain ways?
Yes. For instance, you know, Leonard Woolf worked in the same area that I worked in. Possibly he got to much greater contact with village life because of the fact that he, his circuits were riding into the village. Possibly he did 10 miles a day. By motor car you could do, well, anything, 150 miles a day. The result was you dashed out and you may dash back. But the tradition of dashing back to headquarters in the 1930s certainly did not prevail. And men like Leach insisted that the assistants spend nights out, live in the rest house or circuit bungalow out before they came back to headquarters.
Now, there is a criticism made that the values and the orientation were Western or quasi-Western, and that there was a gap between the governed and the rulers, the administrators.
Yes, there were. I would agree that there was a gap in. You know, values were changing. The rural society was very much in, even in the low country, in a district like Hambantota, feudal. They accepted the chief headman, the mudaliar, as a traditional representative of government. And I think nobody was horrified if the headman's clerk collected a fee to get a job done, even as late as the 30s. It was the middle-class intellectual who was protesting against it and said, here is a public servant who is being corrupt. As far as the villager was concerned, I think from historic times, he paid something in kind or something in cash to get his work done by servant. It was a period of change. The concepts and values of the administrators were very largely Western, I would concede. The concepts and values of the headman, the Vidhanarachi, the village headman, and the mudaliar in the low country, were, I wouldn't say Oriental, but feudal.
In fact, how far were you dependent on the headman for ordinary matters? Were you almost at their mercy to some extent?
You know, possibly less dependent than a European officer coming out to Ceylon. Factual information.
You would have more.
Well, possibly I would be in a better position to judge whether the headman was telling me a lie or not, mm-hmm. whether he was. But again, to a very large extent, one was dependent on the village headman for factual information. And even the mid-40s, I recollect expressing an opinion in my official diary that the social services of the government were very largely administered for the benefit of the friends and relatives of the village headman, because administration was so dependent on factual information supplied by the village headman.
Even when you were GA NCP,
yes.
Weren't you to some extent, to a considerable extent, dependent on headman or gram sevakas or whoever it was?
Yes, but some concept of associating representative opinion had crept in. I remember by the late 40s, we had a flash flood in Batticaloa district, and instead of asking the village headman to give me a list of all the people whose houses were damaged, we appointed a committee of the village committee member, the Belvidani, and the village headman to produce a list. And it was much more satisfactory list because it possibly represented the three rival power groups in the village. And nobody's interests were neglected. There was greater inclination as the years went by to associate elected representatives in administration.
Wouldn't you call this the natural result of the extension of the franchise and of independence?
I say definitely. You see, the first thing that Aksapra produced was resentment of the chief headman. And that was polished. And the DRO system was introduced. And soon after that, the Vidhanayarachi and Korlimatsnes were abolished. But the basic grassroots worker, you wanted somebody in the village doing crime and supplying factual information to government. The village headman remained. The basis of selection was yet on the basis of influence rather than merit based on academic or education standards. Well, the last government changed it to Grama Sevaka, who was selected on the basis of an examination. And the extent of support he got from the Member of Parliament. I don't think a very great doubt of the matter. The last reform was an improvement of what it prevailed.
What factors give rise to these doubts?
You know, in the village, yet the village headman is a peace officer. If there is crime, first person to whom it is reported. All the island is not covered by police stations. First person to whom it is reported is the village headman. Well, the village headman must be a person who can at least command and the respect of people to go to a scene and even a small brawl to bring it under control. If you get a person from outside, he has neither the prestige nor the support in the village to perform that function. We appoint a village headman from outside, we don't give him a residence in the village. He's possibly boarding in a boutique, in a room in a boutique. And certainly a person who is living in a boutique, in a room in a boutique, does not command any semblance of respect from his fellow villagers.
And I presume he has to meet all the latent opposition of the former headman and their family?
Oh yes, very definitely. No, but you see, if we're going to have a straight bureaucracy, a representative elected, selected on merit, appointed to the rural areas to work at grassroots level, it is going to be an expensive process. We're going to house him properly, we're going to give him a proper office, we're going to pay him adequately. But you can't pay him the wages or little more than the wages of the old village headman, who had the tradition of accepting kind for any services rendered, to whom the village paid on a bound. to pay cash or something in kind for any assistance.
And there have been complaints that these Brahma Sevakas are partial to one party or the other.
Oh yes, you see the... the reforms really were very much mixed up in politics. There was a feeling that the old traditional headman was the support of the conservative UNP. The new group selected very much on political influence, as a final contrary, other things being equal. First, they owed allegiance to the SLP government who were in power at that time. So they've got tainted politically, and it'll take a very long time before we can make them neutral public servants serving a democratic state.
Mm-hmm. With regard to the civil servants themselves in the first few decades of your experience, would you say that they were willing to take responsibility on their own shoulders, and if they considered it best, even to overrule the public opinion of the district or opinion of the MP of the district?
You know, in the early years, the colonial tradition persisted, and as far as the government agent was concerned, he paid very little attention to the views of the Member of Parliament. The Member of Parliament came maybe to get some bit of assistance for a supporter or to attend to some pressing need. The Kacharit, I think, paid much more attention to the views of the government agent than to the views of the Member of Parliament. But there came a period of change where the government agent found that the Member of Parliament was able to exert much greater influence in Colombo. And often, if a government agent violently disagreed with him, the government agent got shifted. I remember discussing this question with Mr. D.S. Sirenaga in the mid-40s, when a number of incidents occurred, and he came and stayed with me in Matra, and I told him, this is very unfair. An officer cannot do his job without fear or favor if on the ex parte representations of member of the state council, he shifted or he's queried. Well, give me a very, very frank answer. He says, okay, if you and your Member of Parliament or Member of State Council quarrel, I can't shift the Member of State Council. I pass no judgment, but I can shift you. I don't want a headache. I want his support in the House. Mm-hmm. But you see, these incidents that I described showed that the administration tried to get on without too much pressure, subjecting itself to pressure from the local Member of Parliament. But the local Member of Parliament did exert pressure. In the early stages, the pressure came by exerting pressure in Colombo on the Minister, the Chief Secretary, and it trickled down. But now the situation is very different. The administration very largely depends on cordiality of relationship between administration and elected representative in the district.
With regard to the colonial attitude, would you go so far as to say that it was almost disdainful?
For a start, it was disdainful, and I think the sensible administrator listened to all representations which were made on behalf of the people by members of parliament or members of number of district agricultural committee, assistance committees and whatnot, where it was done objectively, where there was effort to pressurize, to support a group or an individual, there was resistance. I think that was it. Sometimes there was a... In the early 30s there was, I think, among Europeans and some Colonies too, there was resentment at members of Parliament or state councillors trying to assert themselves.
The gap having closed nowadays and a greater identification having evolved, isn't there the opposite danger of this guardianship concept and the incorruptibility of the service being lost?
Yes, that is one of the... Well, great changes that have occurred in the transition in these years. The civil service was a small group of 133 officers who considered themselves an elite group with standards of their own and integrity, high standards of integrity. Now it has become an administrative service consisting of about 1,000 and more officers. That sense of an elite group is no longer exists. Even the fellow feeling does not exist. That I sometimes wonder whether too much of the desire to get on, and the best way to get on is to get on with your Member of Parliament, is not growing to the disadvantage of good administration, damage to good administration.
And doesn't it give rise to all sorts of pressures which lead to favoritism?
Very definitely, these pressures assert themselves very much in the administration of social services and appointments. In the administration of social services, today I think it would be correct to say that who is in need and what is the degree of need is left to the judgment of the Member of Parliament. And the cost of social services has grown tremendously. Mm-hmm. In making of appointments, there is tremendous effort to pressurize the public officers on this shrewd argument that, we want persons who are loyal to the party in power and will faithfully carry out our policies. And I have known heaps of persons who were recommended as party loyalists who at the general elections worked against the party, but able to go and form a Member of Parliament and he comes forward as a party loyalist. But however, it's tremendous, as long as this degree of unemployment exists in our country, the temptation, the pressure on the politician to find jobs for those who have actively supported it will be there. I think we'll have to inevitably go through a spoil system before we come to anything more and more sensible and fair. And that depends on how quickly we solve our problems of growth.
It all comes back to that, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It comes back to the pressures of members of Parliament themselves from constituents who want jobs for their children is tremendous. If there were full employment, members of Parliament wouldn't be bothered. They don't like to pressurize people, waste their time hanging about offices to get jobs.
It's not only members of Parliament. I heard the remark that, say, at Agarwalta, for instance, after 65, and the real source of influence there was not Munna Singha, but Don David, because by virtue of the fact that the government was UNP. Does that happen?
Oh, yes, very definitely. Mm. I think with the change of government, not merely the government's member of the party group, MP, but the defeated candidate in the constituency was able to get more from ministers than the member of opposition member of parliament.
What would you say to the argument of the politicians, especially with regard to the higher jobs in the civil service or corporations, saying that that it is necessary to have a man partial to their party to implement their policies?
Every political party that was defeated in Ceylon has ultimately blamed the top administrators for their defeat. Policies of the parties that have changed were not so radically different. Social policies, maybe their cultural policies, were different. Administering the policies did not require party loyalty. It required integrity, efficiency. Certainly, political parties view, when they come new to power, view senior administrators who had worked long years cordially with the government that had been defeated with considerable suspicion. I remember very clearly Mr. Bandaranaike. In 1956, he summoned the GA to a conference, and he was during the elections, possibly there were allegations that some of the public servants had been UNP partisans. He told them, if you can't work with us, get out. He was very, very harsh. I was there as land commissioner at the conference, but I was also chairman of the Civil Service Association. I got up and told him in conference, in the presence of everybody, his colleagues, I said, sir, you're not entitled to speak to us in those terms. Propound your policies, issue your directives. When we fail to carry them out, you're entitled to speak to us in those terms. We've heard very little of new policies. We've heard very few directives. We've had so much talk of disloyalty. I think it's unwarranted. Mm-hmm. But I was interested to read that even the United States of America, where they have the spoiled system, but they have large cadres of responsible officers, foreign service and internal service, as engineering corps, army, permanent. Kennedy found that too many of his foreign service officers were Dallas-minded, and all Kennedy's White House staff thought that they had the most inefficient foreign service. Possibly politicians coming new feel suspicious of the old group. But you raise the question whether it is necessary to make the change, where policies are radically different, where a socialist government succeeds a conservative government. Maybe that to faithfully carry out a socialist policy, key positions should be entrusted to persons who are in sympathy with the social philosophy of the party in power. But when policies are not so radically different, this cry is only an effort to find jobs for the boys. And in Ceylon, the effort to find jobs for the boys, not even for the competent boys, the least competent. It is scandalous
Didn't D.S. Senayake to some extent start this game himself, in the sense that when he was Minister of Agriculture and Lands under the Donamo Constitution, he got rid of several European officers in key posts. And one almost suspects that he liked to have yes men.
I wouldn't say yes men. I know there was a very strong feeling among the Europeans at that time. I was a young cadet in the Secretariat in 1935, and Sri Vikramasinghe. Was not the most, the post of land commissioner at that time was, you know, number two post in the civil service, or number three post in the civil service. Sri Vikramasinghe was certainly number three in order of seniority, but DS appointed him to the post.
And there was number three.
He was not number three. He got promoted out of turn to that position. I remember Northcroft was a few years senior to me in service, walking across the corridor and coming to me and saying, "Don't you think it's scandalous what DS has done, appointing CL to the post of land commissioner and so many seniors?" I said, "I don't feel very horrified about it, because once upon a time the thick colour of your skin counted. Now it is whether you're a friend of DS. There was no absolute justice then, there was no absolute justice now. My skin is dark. Possibly I favour this order of things in the bulletin, but there was that feeling, yes. But I wouldn't say DS wanted yes men. Sri Vikramasinghe was not a yes man. Edmund Rodrigo was not a yes man. Edmund Rodrigo too got preference from Sri Vikramasinghe and I. They quarrelled violently.
No, I was wondering whether the fact that eventually he got rid of Edmund was could be taken as a sign of his intolerance of opposition.
But you see, DS was certainly not an intellectual. He had certain hunches. How he reached those hunches was a mystery. Some of them were good, some of them were not so good. And, well, if you could persuade him out of those hunches by a gradual process of wearing out, and I've seen C.L. Vikramasinghe very successfully do it. Rodrigo is a not so patient person, and Rodrigo used to be brusque. Mm-hmm. And you know, C.L. old GSN and I have been in power for a long period. I was getting to the stage where he resented brusqueness.
I see. This is very interesting about C.L. Working in a persuasive manner, and I presume far more subtly than Rodrigo.
Oh yes, far more subtly. I was a good friend of all three. Though I was very young, I was a very good friend of Sri Vikramasinghe. Rodrigo was a good friend of mine, and Mr. J.S.L. Nack, as government agent, as Minister of Agriculture, often used to come and stay with us. Sri Vikramasinghe had the great advantage of working on the same floor as GSN and I. Often they lunched together. Mr. Rodrigo lived in Peridenia. They met occasionally, possibly more frequently when they disagreed. So they met to disagree. But often evening on circuit they used to sit down and play bridge together. Personal relationships, not so bad, but Rodrigo had disadvantages. He was not so constantly in his company.
Isn't it correct to say that DS gathered round him a band of trusted advisors? I was not thinking of merely of the political triumvirate of OEG and DR possibly.
Yes.
But for general administration, he had a trusted group.
You see, he certainly made a conscious effort to handpick officers who were interested in his field of work. Having picked them, he gave them opportunity, put them in key positions, gave them support. It was in some instances, it was a case of personal like of an individual, person who knew the family. Some cases, it was interest in a particular project, looking around to see the man who would promote that project best, and putting him in charge.
No, I was wondering whether, say, C.L., Jans, and then late A.G. Ranasinghe and Richard Alvihara and others could be called his particularly, even Saravanuttu, his...
You know, they were the senior civil servants about the time that he attained power. He used them. They were the people, all the names you mentioned were people who did revenue work, who therefore were engaged in land work, which D.S. was in charge of, and therefore came under his direct notice. Sir Richard was in NCP, Mr. Jans was a land settlement officer, therefore came to his personal notice. Ranasinghe was...
had been his secretary.
His secretary for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Secretary during.
No, and also, but Kantaya Vaidyanathan was not a land...
You see, Vaidyanathan became his permanent secretary. Vaidyanathan was associated with the political sector from the Dodoma Constitution onwards. He was the first secretary to Sir Baron Jayakalik in the Home Ministry. Then he was secretary to Sir John Kothalawala. Then he was associated with T.S. Sirinath during wartime as his purchasing officer in Delhi. So he was in contact with the political sector right from the middle 30s.
Arising from this, I was wondering about the question, the position of the permanent secretaries, because I know sometime under D.S. Sennaika's premiership, Malhol took exception to one permanent secretary being removed simply because the minister didn't like him.
You see, the permanent secretary's minute makes it perfectly clear that the office is a political appointment. We're not appointed by the Public Service Commission, which takes office outside the purview of politics. We're appointed by the Governor General on the recommendation of the Prime Minister. So, on the same principle that I can't shift your minister, I can shift you. Often the effort is made to adjust. But if the adjustment is not possible, reversion back. But reversion back has occurred. How many times? Poor Langtry was reverted back, I think, once. I don't know. Moore acted. Did he retire as permanent secretary or retire as GA? Candy.
Gunaratna?
Which Gunaratna?
WD with Mrs. Nirmala Vijayawardene.
Yes, but Gunaratna was not retired, he was promoted.
Mm-hmm.
He was made ambassador somewhere. That's a very, very well-known method of easing a difficult situation.
Now, there is a general public feeling today that, in the past decade or so, the past two decades, some permanent secretaries have tended to tone down their opinions and even not given independent opinion, but swing with the known opinions of the minister.
Yes, I think it is true. It is first because of a very grave defect in the permanent secretaries themselves. The whole civil service, you were trained to administer settled policy. You did not get much training in the making of new policy.
Mm-hmm.
And what ministers in an independent country wanted was new policy. They wanted something new, something popular. And very few of the civil servants trained in the colonial tradition proved equal to the responsibility. One of the things that the issues became economic. The problems of growth had to be tackled as problems of the investment of scarce resources to maximize returns for reinvestment. You know, beyond the
in the most civil service. Civil servants who are trained in the old school beyond the ken of even the modern civil servant whose administrative service officer has not been trained in these lines.
In fact, I was going to ask you how you found the more recent acquisitions of the service, people coming out of the Sinhalese and Tamil mediums.
You know, I don't meet many of them except I sometimes participate in a sort of induction course that is given to them. The last group that was recruited, I called from the Public Service Commission, the marks, their background, and I find that certainly administrative service is no longer considered to be the prestige employment in the island. And out of about 50 that were recruited that year, less than 12 had classes in their degree. The majority were chaps, had past degrees, who had been schoolmasters a number of years. Certainly the public service is not attracting the best minds in the country. They often find opportunity elsewhere. But in a report we submitted to the Prime Minister about 2 years ago, we suggested that one of the causes is that the initial salary is insufficient. People, certainly good graduate prefers to stay in the university.
It is becoming doubtful.
It's becoming even doubtful that some prefer to go into the income tax, which provides a better initial salary, less prospects of transfer out of Colombo than the private sector. You know, but the point is, the interference can be exciting, but if you spend a lifetime in dull jet drudgery obsessing other people's income, I don't know that there's much choice. I prefer the interference, the resistance of interference.
I would agree there.
I have very many happy recollections of rows I've had with politicians, and well, I think it is an article too.
How do you find the group that got in the late 50s and early 50s? They haven't got the colonial tradition, I presume.
No, we had, you know, we had a group between, say, 90, immediate post-war to about the mid-50s, a very good group. Many shouldering very great responsibility and proving equal to their responsibilities. They had certainly a more modern outlook and much more aware of the economic issues of the age. The better ones. The bad ones, possibly, that's bad, or not worse than the old bad batch.
With respect to the old batch, I was wondering whether in your days as AGA and GA, sometimes you took on the secretariat in the sense that you know, the traditional sort of row between the province and the secretariat dwellers ever occurred.
Oh yes, very often it used to occur, because sometimes you found a chap who escaped, avoided, fought with a circumstance, prevented working in the district, sitting down in a ministry and raising queries which, if he had spent 2 hours in a country, he would never raise. Certainly we used to have some little tussles on that basis. Davidson spent much of his life quarreling with the secretary, chief sex office, and with the various headquarters on these issues. But, you know, invariably the query was raised by a colleague of yours or your age group or somebody whom you knew, and you often settled it with a demi-official or a telephone call.
Yeah. How much was initiative encouraged, or was it clamped upon?
It depended on your immediate bosses. I remember, I wonder whether I told you this, on the last occasion when I worked in the health ministry, and I went to Martha. And at that time, there was no tradition of any person going out to do land work getting any instruction on it. It was presumed that you go and study the legislation, read up the old files, and you pick up the trends of work. I was a little nervous, so I knew Mr. Seelvik. I spent a fortnight in his office.
Seelvik?
Yes. And he spent time explaining government policies, objectives of government policies. And I went to Martha with great enthusiasm and found, you know, having given out land, they discovered that just giving a peasant a piece of land is insufficient. You must assist him to clear the land.